You know, when you think about childhood, it often feels like, well, like you are following a highly detailed map.
Oh, absolutely. The path is pretty much drawn out for you.
Right. You have preschool, then elementary school, middle school, high school. The boundaries are clear, and, you know, there are guides everywhere you look.
Yeah, teachers, counselors, parents steering the ship.
Exactly. But then you hit early adulthood. And for many people, especially neurodivergent individuals, it can feel like you just walked right off the edge of that map.
Yeah, that is a really common feeling.
Suddenly, all that structured terrain is just gone. You're staring out at a wilderness. So, okay, let's unpack this. Today, our mission is to explore a comprehensive strategy for preparing autistic teens for part-time jobs.
And we are drawing on a wealth of research, practical guides, and specific methodologies from Angel Sense.
Right, and we are looking specifically at how to balance building their independence with ensuring their safety in the workplace. Because that transition is huge for you, for the listener, whether you're a parent or just someone interested in neurodiversity.
It really is. The transition from that highly structured environment of the school system into the adult world is, well, it's one of the most profound shifts any family can go through.
Because the safety net is just gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The supports that were simply built into the daily routine, like the predictable schedules, the specialized educators, the tailored sensory environments, they just vanish.
Which is terrifying.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Schools for autistic children are fantastic resources, but students age out, usually in their early 20s. After that, families are largely left to engineer their own pathways.
Right.
And a part-time job for an autistic teen, it is not just about bringing home a paycheck. It serves as a critical bridge to long-term autonomy.
It's like a practice run for adulthood.
Yes,
Yeah.
it provides a real-world controlled space to practice financial management. It forces the building of new routines that literally get them out of the house.
Which is so important.
And crucially, it offers a structured environment for social interaction, allowing them to practice navigating complex interpersonal dynamics while applying their natural strengths.
So it really provides a framework for adulthood. But before a teen can reap those developmental benefits, we kind of have to establish a baseline, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because you can't just drop someone into the workforce and hope for the best. There has to be a brutally honest assessment of whether they possess the foundational bandwidth for that specific environment.
Right, and we have to start by acknowledging a reality that can sometimes be pretty difficult for families to process.
Which is?
Not every autistic person is going to fit into a traditional workplace, and that is entirely okay.
Yeah.
For example, a teen diagnosed with level 3 autism, which involves profound challenges with verbal communication, severe distress when routines are altered, and requiring very substantial daily support.
Right.
They might benefit far more from community inclusion activities. We are talking about structured art programs, specialized music therapy, or supported recreational groups.
So the goal is meaningful engagement, not forcing neuroconformity.
Exactly. But for teens who fall into the gray area, those who are gaining independence but still require accommodations, readiness really hinges on specific functional skills.
Which means looking at, like, how their brain actually processes daily operational demands.
Precisely. Like, can they follow multi-step directions?
Because a workplace is just a constant stream of new compounding instructions.
No, for sure. And how is their time management? We aren't just talking about, reading a clock.
Right.
We're talking about the executive function required to wake up, initiate a morning routine, calculate travel time, and transition from one task to another without experiencing immense neurological friction.
Yeah, the transition piece is huge.
Yeah. And we also have to evaluate emotional regulation. If a teen's nervous system is easily overwhelmed to the point of, say, frequent meltdowns or non-responsive shutdowns, the baseline pressure of a customer-facing job might just be too destabilizing.
Okay, I look at this readiness assessment sort of like learning to swim.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like you don't just throw someone in the deep end of the pool to see if they can handle it. You check if they can tread water in the shallow end first. You evaluate their baseline skills. But wait, I have to push back a little here.
Sure, go ahead.
What if a teen doesn't check every single box on that functional skills list? Let's say their time management is solid, but their working memory struggles with those multi-step directions. Like, doesn't that mean the workforce is entirely off limits for them?
No, not at all. Readiness does not mean total unassisted independence. The goal of assessing these functional skills isn't to gatekeep employment.
Okay.
It is to identify the specific sources of friction so you can engineer the right support systems.
I see.
Yeah. If you know a teen struggles with auditory, multi-step directions, that doesn't mean they can't work. It means they need an environment that provides visual checklists or, you know, a manager who communicates tasks sequentially rather than all at once.
So it's about the right fit.
Exactly. The objective is to match their current capabilities with an environment where they can thrive, rather than placing them in a situation where they are just barely surviving the sensory and cognitive load of their shift.
Thriving versus surviving. That is the perfect metric. So, assuming a family has mapped out those capabilities and identified where the friction lies, the next massive hurdle is translating that baseline into a real-world role.
Right. And this requires evaluating both the physical and social architecture of a potential job.
Okay. What kind of roles usually work well?
Well, historically, classic roles that often align well with neurodivergent strengths include inventory management, stocking shelves, library work, database entry, or pet care.
Because they're predictable.
Yes. These roles tend to be highly structured, rule-based, and somewhat insulated from unpredictable social demands. But the task itself is really only half the equation.
Right.
The physical environment is arguably more important. You have to audit the workplace. Like, what are the lighting conditions?
Oh, like fluorescent lights.
Exactly. Fluorescent lights, for example, aren't just bright. They flicker at a frequency that many neurodivergent brains struggle to filter out.
Wow.
Yeah. And it causes a constant low-level alarm state in the central nervous system.
So it's like finding the right pair of shoes. It has to fit their specific sensory needs perfectly. Otherwise, it's just going to cause blisters the whole time.
That's a great way to put it.
Because if their sensory gating system is constantly misfiring because of a buzzing light or sudden loud noises, they have literally zero cognitive bandwidth left to actually do the job.
Exactly. And you also have to evaluate the managerial culture. Well, a supervisor whose communication style relies heavily on sarcasm, implied subtext, or reading between the lines is going to create constant anxiety for an autistic teen who processes language literally.
Oh, that makes total sense.
Yeah. Finding a manager who is explicit, direct, and accommodating is the difference between retention and rapid burnout.
So once you identify a promising environment, you enter the application phase.
Right. And this is where families really need to act as heavily involved architects. Families should be helping customize resumes to highlight specific literal strengths. Mm. And more importantly, they need to use visual scripts and role play to simulate interview scenarios.
But wait, let me challenge that approach for a second.
Okay.
Is it actually a good idea for parents to be so heavily involved in things like scripting the resume and micromanaging the interview practice? Doesn't that defeat the purpose of independence?
I can see why you'd ask that.
Like, if the parent is doing the heavy lifting just to get them in the door, how on earth are they going to function independently once the parent is gone?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the process is not about doing the work for them. It is about providing cognitive scaffolding.
Cognitive scaffolding.
Huh? Yeah. The executive function required to hunt for a job, formatting a document, decoding ambiguous job descriptions, initiating contact, it is notoriously taxing.
It's exhausting for anyone, really.
Right. And for an autistic teen, that cognitive load can trigger burnout before they even secure an interview.
Oh, wow.
So by taking on the structural elements, the parent frees up the teen's mental energy to focus on the actual interpersonal performance of the interview.
That makes a lot of sense.
And you practice those role plays not just to memorize answers, but to build a neural pathway. When the inevitable anxiety of the real interview hits, their brain has a well-worn groove to fall back on, which prevents a freeze response.
So the scaffolding absorbs the initial structural weight so the teen can focus on the specific task at hand. That makes total sense.
Exactly.
And there's a critical legal and psychological component to this application phase as well, right? Because in many countries, disclosing a disability during the interview process or even on the application is completely optional.
Yes. There is no legal obligation to wave a flag and announce it.
Yep.
And empowering the teen to make that choice is a massive step in their autonomy.
Because masking is so hard.
Masking, which is the conscious effort to hide neurodivergent traits to appear neurotypical, is completely exhausting.
Yeah.
Some teens may choose to disclose their autism up front because they want to request immediate accommodations, you know, and filter out incompatible employers right away.
Right. Weed out the bad managers early.
Exactly. Others may choose to keep it private until they establish their competency in the role.
Yeah.
Giving them the agency to control their own narrative is just foundational.
Okay, so let's follow that trajectory. They handle the interview. They secure the job. The scaffolding gets them through the door. But day one on the job is merely the starting line, isn't it? The actual neurological heavy lifting is going to happen in the messy, unpredictable reality of, like, a Tuesday afternoon shift.
Oh, absolutely. Securing the role is the theory. The daily grind is the practice.
So how do you manage that transition?
To manage the cognitive toll, a proven strategy is negotiating for short shifts initially, like 2 to 3 hours to start, gradually building stamina.
That makes sense.
But the most vital mechanism for long-term success is instituting a structured daily debrief.
What does that look like?
The family needs to sit down after every single shift and systematically review the operational and emotional events of the day.
Is that because of processing delays? Like, an interaction with a rude customer might happen at 2 in the afternoon, but the neurological fallout of that interaction might not register for the teen until they are sitting on the couch at 7 in the evening.
Yes, precisely. They may not recognize in the moment that a minor change, like a different route to the break room or a new coworker talking too loudly, is draining their battery. The daily debrief helps them connect the external trigger to their internal emotional state. It allows the family to identify invisible friction, brainstorm solutions, and, you know, consciously celebrate small victories that might otherwise get lost in the fatigue.
Right. And this daily review naturally transitions into what is probably the most important workplace survival tool.
Yeah.
Self-advocacy.
Yes. Speaking up, it is the cornerstone of sustainable employment.
But that's so hard.
It is. Autistic teens often struggle to read the subtle social cues of when and how to ask for help. They need to be explicitly coached.
How explicit are we talking?
Families should provide literal, memorized scripts. Simple, direct statements like, I'm not processing this task. Can you write it down? Or, I am experiencing sensory overload and need to step away for 5 minutes. Or even just, is this an appropriate time to ask a question?
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Advocating for yourself, setting boundaries, looking a superior in the eye and saying, I am overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. These are things that neurotypical adults fail at constantly.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you see people who have been in the corporate workforce for 20 years who will quietly suffer through burnout rather than risk the social discomfort of telling their manager they need a break.
Yep, it happens all the time.
So we are asking a neurodivergent teenager to navigate complex workplace power dynamics that baffle grown adults. How does a family practically coach that?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, you realize that this training goes far beyond saving a part-time job at a grocery store.
Okay.
When a family role plays who to approach, like identifying the difference between venting to a coworker and reporting an issue to HR, and explicitly scripts how to professionally articulate a boundary, they're building the architecture of adult autonomy.
Right.
A script bypasses the prefrontal cortex's struggle to translate distress into socially acceptable workplace norms in real time.
So they don't have to think of the words while they're panicking.
Exactly. When you give them those explicit phrases, you are handing them a tool they will use for the rest of their lives.
Oh, wow.
They will rely on that exact same communication framework when dealing with an unreasonable landlord, when navigating friction in a romantic relationship, or when seeking medical care.
You are giving them the vocabulary of self-preservation.
Yeah.
That is so powerful.
Yeah.
But, you know, even with perfect vocabulary and an incredibly supportive manager, systems just break down. Life introduces variables.
It always does.
A delivery truck blocks the entrance, the power goes out, a customer starts screaming. When the environment becomes hostile, you need more than just good communication. You need a robust, multi-layered safety net.
Yes, you really do. And the first layer of that safety net addresses logistics and the commute. The family cannot just map out the bus route on their phone. They have to execute physical practice runs of the commute before day one.
Right.
But beyond the ideal route, they have to engineer protocols for disruptions.
Which introduces a highly specific vulnerability. Autistic time blindness.
Exactly. Time blindness is a deficit in the internal mechanism that senses the passage of time. If a bus is delayed due to weather, a neurotypical person will organically realize after, say, 50 minutes that they need to pivot to a backup plan.
Right. They get antsy.
But an autistic teen with time blindness might not register the duration of the delay. They could wait indefinitely at a bus stop, entirely missing their shift, without realizing they're in an escalating situation.
It's like being placed in a waiting room that has no windows and no clocks.
Yes.
You are entirely aware that you are waiting, but you have absolutely zero internal gauge of whether you have been sitting in that chair for 5 minutes or 5 hours. Unless an external tool violently interrupts your focus to tell you what time it is, you will just remain seated.
That is a perfect analogy. And the mitigation strategy for that is establishing a rigid externalized routine.
Like what?
Like setting a vibrating watch alarm for a 10-minute threshold. If the alarm goes off and the bus isn't there, they trigger the pre-established backup plan.
So that addresses the vulnerability of getting to the building. The next layer is the physical environment itself.
Sensory safety. And this goes far beyond identifying emergency exits or, lifting heavy items safely. We are talking about internal
Like the
risks.
lighting we talked about.
Right. Or if a mandatory uniform involves a stiff, scratchy collar, or if the workplace plays constant background music, those aren't just annoyances.
They're actual threats.
Yes. For a neurodivergent brain, compounding sensory stressors can trigger a biological threat response. The amygdala hijacks the brain, leading to a complete shutdown, an explosive meltdown, or wandering.
Wandering.
Yeah, elopement, where the teen physically flees the environment to escape the stimuli. And wandering is a massive physical safety risk.
I can imagine.
To prevent this, coping mechanisms must be established proactively. This means negotiating accommodations, like wearing noise-canceling headphones between customer
Or
interactions.
using fidget spinners.
Yes, using discrete fidget tools to regulate nervous energy, or designating a specific dimly lit room where the teen can go the moment they feel their sensory bucket overflowing.
Which brings us to the ultimate fail-safe technology. Because when the commute breaks down and the sensory environment triggers a flight response, you need a final layer of security.
You do.
And this involves highly specialized tools like AngelSense GPS trackers. These aren't just standard phone apps, right?
No, they utilize a robust combination of satellite, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth to pinpoint a location, even if a teen wanders off their known route or enters a thick concrete building.
And it also involves communication devices equipped with an automatic pickup feature.
That auto answer function is critical. If a teen is in the middle of a severe sensory shutdown, they may become entirely nonverbal, or they might lack the fine motor control to physically answer a ringing phone.
Oh, wow. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, so the auto pickup allows the parent's call to connect automatically. The parent can then speak to the teen to de-escalate the situation, or simply listen to the ambient noise, like traffic or a train intercom, to provide critical context to emergency services.
But let me play devil's advocate here. We started this conversation talking about building independence and autonomy. Does utilizing GPS trackers and auto-answering phones that let parents listen in cross the line into intense helicopter parenting?
It's a fair question.
Like, are we undermining their autonomy by electronically tethering them to their family, hindering the very independence we are trying to build?
This raises an important question, and it is a philosophical tension that honestly every special needs family wrestles with. But the critical distinction here is the difference between surveillance and a structural fail-safe.
Okay, explain that.
The objective of this technology is to facilitate autonomy with dignity. If a teen experiences profound sensory overload and elopes into a busy intersection, which is a life-threatening biological flight response,
Yeah.
high-quality tracking ensures their physical survival.
It's the difference between forcing a teenager to hold your hand while they walk down the street versus letting them walk completely on their own but wearing a safety harness. They are navigating the terrain, making their own choices, and building their own muscles. The harness doesn't do the walking for them. It just ensures that if they slip off the cliff, they don't fall to their death.
Right. It allows the teen to board that bus, navigate the workplace, and experience the dignity of risk without requiring a parent to physically hover over them in the break room all day.
Right.
It provides the invisible infrastructure that makes taking those independent steps psychologically possible for both the teen and the intensely anxious family.
So what does this all mean? When we look at this entire ecosystem, from rigorously assessing their baseline cognitive load to shielding them from the executive burnout of the application process.
To scripting their boundaries.
Right, and engineering a sensory safety net. Preparing an autistic teen for the workforce is an incredibly deliberate act of architecture.
It really is.
It requires stripping away the assumed norms of the workplace and rebuilding them based on explicit communication and biological reality. And for you listening, whether you are a parent guiding a teen through this gauntlet, or an employer looking to optimize your team, or just a coworker sharing a shift, recognizing the necessity of these accommodations is vital. It
Absolutely.
doesn't just check a diversity box, it builds a highly functional, deeply empathetic, and secure environment for everyone.
And, Examining this intensely structured support system leaves me with a rather provocative thought.
Well, lay it on me.
We have spent this entire discussion dissecting how optimizing sensory environments, enforcing literal and direct communication, establishing daily protocols to monitor emotional friction, and explicitly teaching employees how to set boundaries without fear of retaliation are incredibly effective at stabilizing autistic teens.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine what would happen if the broader corporate world universally adopted those exact same practices for all employees.
Oh, wow. Think about the implications of that.
Right. What if every single new hire, regardless of their neurotype, was handed a literal, explicit manual for navigating workplace power dynamics? What if every open plan office actively managed fluorescent lighting and auditory chaos as a matter of occupational health?
That would be amazing.
What if daily check-ins, designed to preemptively catch burnout before it causes a meltdown, were just the managerial standard? Could the accommodations we currently reserve strictly for neurodivergent individuals actually serve as the secret universal blueprint for curing the chronic burnout and toxic friction that plagues the modern workforce?
That is a staggering concept to consider, because the reality is, neurotypical or neurodivergent, so many people are suffering in silence simply because corporate environments refuse to acknowledge human limits.
We are all, on some level, just trying to navigate the wilderness after the structured map of childhood runs out, realizing that literal communication, sensory respect, and a little grace might be the compass we all desperately need. Well, it changes the way you look at the workplace entirely. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.